welcome back to the Film Fund Podcast. I'm your host, founder, and executive producer at the Film Fund, Thomas Verity. I'm also an award-winning filmmaker, producer, and film festival judge. I started the Film Fund to give filmmakers an easier, alternative way to get their films funded. Instead of working on a screenplay, crowdfunding campaign, or grant application, you write one sentence pitching your film for your chance to receive up to $10,000 and other prizes to make it. Our summer 2022 narrative and documentary funding contests are open. So check us out at thefilmfund.co as I'm reading an old script here. Check us out at thefilmfund.co to enter your one sentence pitch for a chance to receive up to $10,000 to make your film. Want to remind listeners that contests do happen regularly. So if you are listening at a later date, check the website at thefilmfund.co for the most up-to-date information. Today we have Vinny Anand on the show, previous winner of the Film Fund. Vinny received a three-month subscription to Adobe Creative Cloud, I believe, to help him in post-production of his short film. Vinny, thanks so much for coming on the show. Could you give us a bit of info about yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having me, first of all. And so my name is Vinny Anand. I am a writer, producer, actor. I say that in order of what I do the most of nowadays. So definitely writing takes top priority. Then producing, then acting. I also run a commercial production company. So I shoot commercials for high-end fashion clients for all across the media spectrum, tech. I do a lot of stuff with finance. So basically, I'm able to leverage the experience I have as an independent filmmaker in the commercial world. So that allows me to support myself while I go about making this, you know, the indie films and the TV shows, as you know, not a cakewalk. So
That's awesome. Yeah. And we should definitely talk more often because if you listen to the podcast or keep up with our blog, we recently launched an agency sister company called FF Branded. We're doing a lot of corporate work. At least we're trying to. We have we got Comcast as a client earlier this year. Some other exciting big projects we're working on. We're looking. It's a way to give the Film Fund community job opportunities because the way we produce them is through our community. So we create, we get a client and then we send out an RFP to the community and we like to hire from our community as much as possible. So yeah, it's and that's kind of what sets us apart, right? Because the independent film aspect, a lot of agencies, production companies out there, you get corporate people who are like, oh yeah, how hard could it be? We'll pick up a camera and hire, a cinematographer. But unless you're really practicing real filmmaking, you don't have that storytelling element there. So I think filmmaking and corporate videos really go hand in hand. That experience you learn in independent filmmaking really helps out and it translates super, super well. And that's even like just dealing with clients too. It's like you're able to identify stories in their solutions and their products and you're able to convey to them the concept of the film. I just think it's a great way to make a living. At first, I was like, when I was in college or coming out of college, I was like, oh, I don't want to shoot, you know, corporate videos for companies. I thought it was kind of like, you know, I don't want to be doing that. But I think it's the more I've gotten into it, it's actually super interesting and you can make them creative. So that's awesome, Vinny. Where are you based again?
I'm New York.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. BK, baby. All day.
There you go. What part? I have a friend who lives in Bushwick.
I'm in Flatbush. So like, like 20 minutes south of Bushwick.
Oh, nice.
So.
The only thing I know is Flatbush Zombies is apparently like a hip hop group or something. That's everything.
Yeah.
I know about Flatbush.
Yeah. Like Pop Smoke got shot like four blocks from here. Like,
oh, wow.
Yeah. It's pretty, but I love it, man. It's very Caribbean. It's very like me being a South Asian cat. There's a lot of like Indians here who you think are Indian, but are like Trini or from Guyana.
Oh, really?
And there's like there's like an entire world down here that hasn't really been explored. There's a show called Flatbush Misdemeanors. I'm not sure if you've heard of it or not.
I haven't.
Showtime. No. Yeah, that's the only show that's really like kind of like dived into the actual Caribbean community in New York because it's actually huge. Like people don't really realize there's a huge community of Jamaicans, people from Trinidad, people from Guyana, people from all across. I mean, Haiti. There's like a huge community, and like you like look at them and like, oh, you're just like they look. You know, they're obviously like African American, like they're black, but you know, their roots go into these places that like, you know, are very different than what you perceive. So it's a great place. And like, it's a lot of space over here. Like I got like a two bedroom. I have two bathrooms in my apartment. In the same apartment, I have two bathrooms. You know what I'm saying? So, which is insane. Two full bathrooms, to be correct.
Oh, wow.
Tom. Yeah, it's
damn,
insane.
Look at you, you're living large.
I know.
Those corporate videos are really paying off.
Yeah, you know what? I guess what I'll say is that, like, you know, like, so I'm an artist. My wife, she works for a corporation. She works for a nonprofit, a pretty big one. And so her job is pretty steady. Artist job is up and down, as you know. And we were living in this like small studio in Upper East Side for like years. And it was great because we were saving money and we're putting it away. And I was waiting for my break, obviously, you know, and I was like, well, as soon as we get the break, then we can move out. And she was like, no, you know what? Like, we're not living like this, you know? And I kind of fought her the entire way, but she dragged me kicking and screaming. And thank God she did, because she forced us to give ourselves more space.
Yeah.
And that is personally, professionally, and where you live really, really matters. You know, I know a lot of artists, they get stuck in this very small bubble thinking that like they need to like just keep doing what they're doing. And then like once the art pays off, then they can live life, you know? Yeah. And it's just, it's the wrong way to go about it. Like, you know, it everything gets affected by your life decisions. Your art gets affected by your life decisions. And like a thing that I've always kind of told myself is that art is something I do while I'm here in reality.
Okay.
It is not why I am here. You know what I mean? And it's the amalgamation of your life that gives you the ability to make great art. So yeah, man, space, like
it's all about your experiences.
Yeah.
It's in, and when you're where you're living, you're immersing yourself in a certain culture and a certain ideology, really, who you surround yourself with, your environment. Like I recently moved from one neighborhood in Philly to another one, and it's just a completely different vibe. I'm in Center City now. Before I was in Northern Liberties, and it's just, a lot of people say like Northern Liberties and Fishtown is a little comparable to Brooklyn, and then Center City is kind of more like Manhattan. Although I hate to make that comparison because Philly's so different than New York, but just like it's such a different vibe, and I think it's so much more my vibe here. And it's just like it's night and day with how I'm experiencing the world. Like if I were to write something and I were still living in the other neighborhood, I think it would affect how I see the world and how that script would be conveyed on the screen. I was gonna say on the page, but where you live is so important, because you know you're absorbing everything around you, the energy. It's really what you, how you channel it and how you create something. So that's super cool. I'm glad you love it in where you're living. Now, do you find that you take your experiences and your background and inject them into your work?
100%. I mean,
separate? Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's kind of interesting because I feel like, so I'm my mom is from Rajasthan, India, so she's Hindu. My dad is from Punjab, India, so he's Sikh. And so growing up, I grew up in a Hindu and Sikh household. And so when I was younger, I really kind of leaned into the Sikh faith. I used to wear a turban. And funny story, I grew up in the South. And so I used to wear a turban. I grew up in the South. No one knew if I was boy, girl, Mexican, non-Mexican, what was on my head, you know. And it was one of these things where I was so lost, you know. I had no idea what was going on. And then the cherry on top is that my parents, being Indian, they wanted their kids to have the best education possible, right? They're working four jobs each, and that was a dream. So they say, you know what, we want to send our kids to a private school. But they were Indian, so they were cheap, right? So they sent us to the bargain basement private school, which was the Southern Baptist private school.
Okay.
So now imagine a Sikh turban kid who's learning about Hinduism at home and going to a Southern Baptist Christian school.
And this was in the U.S., the South?
Yeah, this is in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
So you could have, it was in, I mean, it was
that could be a film right there.
Well, it is. It's one of the films, actually, it's kind of funny, like that. So there's a film I'm working on called Holy Turban, and it's about a Sikh kid. Yeah, it's actually based on a true story. It's kind of funny because I look back at my life now and like I was meant to be a storyteller because all this crazy shit happened to me, you know. But like the story is, when I was in sixth grade, you know, I was at this Christian school, and I had this teacher, Mrs. Templeton, real name Mrs. Templeton, and so you know she's like, listen, why don't you, you know, you're always kind of clowning around and you're like a goofball. Why don't you try something? Why don't you put your mind to something? And I was like, yeah, whatever, Miss Templeton. Like, I'm fine. And really what it was is I used comedy as a way to disarm people because I was so different. Like I had people had no idea what to do with me. I had no idea what to do with myself. Yeah. And so comedy became my shield, right? So I figured, man, early on, if I can make people laugh with me, they won't laugh at me, you know? Yeah. And like, it was, dude, it was fucking confusing. Like I would walk into like a boy's bathroom and there'd be like an older, like 60-year-old white guy that's like from the South. That's like, you're in the wrong bathroom.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, I'm not in the wrong, you know what I mean? And it's like, it's tough, I'm in fourth grade, you know? So
yeah, that's hard to handle, especially that
age. It was hard. Yeah. And like, and it wasn't even like the idea of like, I was like, well, no, I'm in the right bathroom. And they're like, you know, no, you're not. It's like, so there was a lot of stuff I had to process, and there's stuff I'm still processing, man, because it never really is fully processed. And so I use comedy as a way, if I can walk in that bathroom and make that guy laugh, then maybe things will be a little less tense, you know? So comedy was always how I kind of dealt with just being so different. And so this teacher was like, hey, why don't you apply yourself one time? Okay, I know you're smart, but for some reason you hide it, you know? And so I was like, all right, one request, Miss Templeton. She's like, I want you to enter a Bible trivia contest. And I was like, what? Yeah, I want you to enter a Bible trivia contest. And I was like,
She asked you to enter that?
She asked me to enter it.
Okay.
And I was like, I'm not going to do that. She's like, come on. What's my one request? You have to honor it. It's like the Godfather, right? I'm like, all right. Cool. You know, yes, I'll do it, but I'm not going to win. I'll go there. And she's like, fine, just enter it. I was like, okay, fine. So I entered it and I started reading the Bible and I'm like, oh man, this is like a big family drama. You know, I was like, it really is. I'm like, you know, and then, there's a lot of parallels to Hinduism because Hinduism has a lot of different characters. It is a big family drama. You know, Sikhism has a lot of stuff. And I was like, oh, so I started to like learn the Bible and I picked it up pretty easily. Mm. And true story, I went to Liberty University, where it's Jerry Falwell country. It's the home of the Christian right. And I won a Bible trivia contest. Oh, wow. As a little Sikh turban kid, I won a Bible trivia contest.
Did you win this contest while you were wearing the turban?
100%. I was on, just imagine the scene where you see this little kid on stage holding up a Bible trivia trophy.
Oh my God, that's crazy. That's amazing.
Yeah, and here's the beautiful part about America, though. The people in the room were not cheering against me. They were cheering for me.
Yeah.
Because what takes precedent over religion in this country? Underdogs.
Yep. I'm from Philly, so we're the capital of the underdog, baby. I love that. That's amazing. So tell me, you said that is a film that you're working on?
Yeah.
It's called Holy Turban?
Holy Turban, yeah. Yeah. Cool. And so there was a lot of interest in that film. And what happened is that was like the first film that me and my partner were working on together. And so when we started shopping that around, people were they loved it. I mean, anyone I tell
this
story.
A feature
story
film
to,
or a short
a feature,
film?
A feature. People were like all about it. But what was happening is that because they hadn't seen our work, they wanted to buy the script and have us go away, right? Yeah. And we were like, well, you know what? We can't do that. So what do we have to do? We have to go all the way back to the beginning and start making smaller pieces to build back up the Holy Turban. So by the time we got to Holy Turban, which is actually coming up now, the next year or so, we'll have enough things to show people where we go, no. Here's a script. You want to be a part of it. We know exactly.
Awesome. That's a good plan. They, that's why we started the film fund too. Short films are so important and it's such a good way to show people like, here's what we can do. Like, and it's on a smaller budget. It lets you experiment a little bit. It lets you learn as well. You know, you're not jumping right into a feature. You're it's a playground essentially. I mean, there's still money involved, obviously, to make a short film with a high production value. You need a budget. But it's so tough to get that funding for shorts and they're so important. It's like, you need to show, what do they call it, your calling card as a director. Like, this is what I can do. Here are a few shorts. Get me in. I want to be involved in this feature. This is my project. It's not just here's the script. I always think of Rocky. And he dropped all the Philly references today. You know, Stallone. I don't think he had any experience. And he fought to, I think he took way less money than he could have gotten for that script for Rocky because he wanted to star in it and he wanted it to be his film. Instead of just selling it outright. So that's a compromise he made and obviously paid off. But yeah, I mean, shorts are a great way to get there. And we're expanding to feature film funding actually. And coming up in September, we're going to launch a program where it's going to be equity crowdfunding. Everyone's going to put in, you know, a minimum investment along with a pitch and we'll release more details about it. And then we'll, I don't want to give too much away, but we're getting into funding soon. So it should be exciting. So tell us about, you talked about some of the highlights about your work in terms of your background growing up, you know, with religion and all the Bible stuff. Is that theme, does that permeate throughout all of your work, or does it really depend?
No, I mean, it's kind of crazy because, you know, I feel like I lived like 9 lives up until this point, because I had that sort of upbringing in the South with the turban. And then what happened is that I cut my hair and I moved to a different part of Virginia, Richmond, Virginia, little more urban, you know, definitely a different vibe than Charlottesville. And no one knew I used to wear a turban. So I kind of went from this sort of outsider, right, with the turban, to this kid who now kind of was funny and knew how to be funny, but didn't have the turban. Mm-hmm. So I went into this place and I became like the class president. I was like the homecoming king, and I was like the cool kid, you know.
So this was high school.
This was high school. Yeah, I was a cool kid, and I never in my entire life have forgotten what it's like to be the weird outside picked on kid.
Yeah.
So like I would do stuff where like, you know, as like the cool kid, even in like the cafeteria at my high school, I would go sit with like the per se loser kids, right? Mm-hmm. I remember I would do this stuff, and like the next day they were like the cool kids, because I was like, I know what that's like. Like I know what's like to be them, you know. Yeah, and if I'm in a position to ever be able to change their experience in any way, then why wouldn't I, you know? Because I've been them. So it was so cool. And then when I moved to Richmond, my mom and dad, they bought a motel in the hood. So like in this really rough part of Richmond, a place called Petersburg, my mom and dad, they bought this hotel that it was right off 95. And this was, you know, it's just like a 40-room hotel. And, you know, it was the halfway point between Miami and New York. And so this hotel during the weekdays was where like gangbangers, prostitution, drug dealers, a lot of firearm exchanges would go down, because it was halfway between New York and Miami. So the whole deal was you meet me like, halfway. And then,
wow. You know what I mean? And like deals, like exchanges, like people were selling guns?
Oh, yeah. Wow. I mean, there was gang fights. I mean, Petersburg still is a pretty rough place. You know, Petersburg itself is a whole history, because it's where they first brought the slaves in from Africa. They would come to Petersburg, Virginia, and then they would go from there and disperse throughout the South. So Petersburg itself has, so you see like Church's Chickens next to these like old rundown like plantation homes. You know what I mean? It's real eerie. It's really a crossroads of America. And also like, I would say that like, it's like really the beginning of like the South. You know, Richmond is like the gateway to the South, you know.
Okay.
So I lived in a hotel room with my mom and my dad. We shared, they slept on a bed.
So you guys
on
lived in the hotel?
In the hotel. Yeah, oh, wow. We lived there. We basically, you know, we worked there full time. Like even during high school, the town was so bad that we would lie and say that I lived with my housekeeper next town over, a place called Hopewell. Which they called Dopewell back in the day.
Oh my God.
You know? Yeah. It was rough, and now it's changed, because Richmond itself is going through its own revival, and now it's a lot of people moving there, but it's still a pretty rough place, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I lived in this motel, and I would go to high school, and I would come home, and I worked a night shift. So I would see so much shit as like a 15, 16 year old. Yeah. And I had to learn how to hustle, you know, like I would do things where like, you know, because the weekdays would be like the locals, and the weekend was like the nice white folk. You know, you would have like the families going back and forth, the construction workers, and we used to pull scams. Like we used to have the marquee sign. This is before internet, right, and phone and stuff. So people weren't like, well, not before internet, but before these things, before the phone. So people couldn't just go down south and be on their phone trying to find like the best deal. This is when people had to pull into a hotel, go and ask the price. Maybe get back in the car, maybe go ask the price across the street. So we have a marquee sign you can see from 95, and it would say studio rooms $21.99, right? So people would see that, they'd always pull in. Wow, you know, we'll take a studio room. And I would wait, and I would ask them questions. I would wait. I would have my eye looking out the window. I wait for like the people with them to get out of the car.
You mean like $22 per night?
$22 per night.
Oh my God.
$22 a night, $21.99. Yeah.
Wow.
And the people outside would wait. And as soon as like the people they were with would get outside, start stretching their legs, I'm like, cool. I'm like, you know, I'll tell you what, sorry, we're sold out of those rooms. Like, oh man, well what's the next best room? Because they're looking back, the kids are like running around, like they don't want to get back in the car. I'm like, oh, right. It's $6 more. No big deal, right? So it'd be $28. They'd pay it with tax, $31, $32, no big deal. Now here's the thing. There were no studio rooms.
Interesting.
So what
would you do?
You would just sell them on a bigger room.
Oh, okay. The ones that were sold out. You actually didn't have any.
You didn't have any. Yeah. Right. You didn't have any. You didn't have any studio rooms. Mm. You know, there were no studio rooms. Like, right, and right. So like it was, so you had to learn at an early age how to hustle. So that is a whole different life than back in Charlottesville, where I was like a turban kid in like the South, you know. Mm-hmm. This was me living in a pretty rough part of the country, living in a motel, working there, living there with my parents and dealing with, you know, a very poverty stricken place.
Yeah. I mean, that's, as I'm sure, you know, the living there was probably a bit difficult at times. I'm sure it was so great for you as a storyteller, you know, all the experiences. And I mean, that's got to be invaluable, like having so much of that inspiration to pull from, just like the experiences you've had.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, it was so, and there's also a series we shot 7 webisodes called The Royal Inn. And it's a series that was about this motel and the whole premise is, so real talk, there was a white guy at the hotel named Laquan. He was a real person. Okay. His name was Laquan.
Not
a usual name for a white guy. And what he would do, he was like a white guy. He looked like Kid Rock. Okay. And back in the day, the Tims were like the thing. So he would have like these like red sweatpants. He rolled them up halfway. He'd have the Tims on. He'd have a white T-shirt on. He would have like a red hoodie, and he would, and his hair was like very like Kid Rockish. Mm-hmm. And so what he would do is, every morning he would go to the Exxon gas station, which is across the street, which was basically the only source of food, water, beverages. You know, it's a food desert. So the Exxon's where everyone goes to eat, right? Wow. And he would go to Exxon, and they used to buy these little like knockoff colognes for like $1. You get like the like fake, like whatever, Gucci, Calvin Klein. And he would douse himself in all of this cologne, right?
Oh my God.
And then when he used to walk out of his room, he smelled like really good. And in the hood, that's currency.
Smelling good?
Yes, it's currency. You see, that's the thing, right? Because people don't have the cars and the house and this and that. So it's like these little things, like him smelling good, gave him some social currency in the hood. And it was like, it was stuff like that that really taught me about character, you know?
Huh. Mm-hmm.
Like, because that's a fucking character, you know? Yeah. It's, you know, like someone who understands how to distinguish himself.
Yeah. Yeah, he was able to give himself that leg up in a way that is completely foreign to me. I mean, like, I think smelling good is important, like, but I usually think about it if I'm going on a date or something, not to elevate myself in society. That's crazy though, but that's a great character. Like, you painted a picture of the character. You did an amazing job of that. Like, I can see this guy.
Yeah.
I can see Laquan. I can smell Laquan.
Right. You know? So yeah, to answer your question, that's what it taught me in about the nuances, because, and also like the crazy thing is that like, when you sit there long enough, you start to, you're like, okay, so like, if I look around, I see poor infrastructure. I see a lack of healthy food options. I see little kids growing up in a hotel room. I see all types of, you know, prostitution, drugs, and all these things. But then I see something else. I see like the way that people treat each other, the way people greet each other. I see how people would really relish these little moments. I see how people will like hug each other, smile at each other, talk to each other, because they didn't have all these material things, you know? And I would say, man, there's a beauty here that you can't find like Beverly Hills or like, you know, so it's,
you get to see real people and really like humanity,
at a
deeper level than Beverly Hills. I don't know how much humanity is really there. I, I don't know. I've only been to LA twice for film festivals. One was with the Film Fund, which is super exciting. It was, who was it? Tim Viola, our first winner, Americana, was at Dances with Films. And we just had another one recently. Oh my God, I'm blanking. It was called Freelance by Mike Urbino. That was just Dances with Films as well. I wasn't able to make it out there, but you know, LA is an interesting place. You know, some people say there are a lot of phony people there. I was at the film festival, so I didn't go to Beverly Hills, but yeah, I mean, it's definitely very posh and fake a lot of the time. And you know, getting to those real pockets of America you don't always see, it helps you. I think it really helps you create characters, and it helps you see how people interact. Like you were saying, it helps you gain a deeper understanding of what the words people are saying actually mean and what their actions signify. Whereas if you grow up kind of in Beverly Hills and everyone acts a certain way, then, or New York or wherever, or even Philadelphia, some neighborhoods, like you're not getting to see real people. You're seeing like people pretending to be other people. Yeah. But yeah, so I think that's super, super valuable. The background you have. And in terms of you using that experience and creating it or channeling it into films, did you go to film school?
No, no.
Yeah, me either.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you ever have an interest in going to film school, or did you? No. Did you go to college?
No, I went to college.
Liberty College, right? You said, or Liberty University.
No, that's where I won the Bible trivia contest.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I went to George Mason University in Northern Virginia, outside D.C. And funny story, I graduated with an economics degree, and then I went and worked corporate America for like 6 months, and I had a soul, so I couldn't stay. And I was like, I got to get out of here. And then when I was like 21, 22, me and my best friend at the time, we decided to go be real estate investors. You know,
so did you graduate from college early then?
Yeah, I did.
22. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
You're like super smart.
Well, you know, I mean, I was good at economics. I could say that, you know, and I think economics really, because I think the business of film or the business of being creative, right? It's very different than the actual creation of the art, right? Like it's like two, like, there, you have to learn how to marry them. And in order to do that, you have to find, well, how can I make art that's true to me and authentic, but also has a commercial value because I have to pay my fucking bills.
Yes.
Right. And this is what we talked about in terms of like doing commercial work, right? Like there is a commercial value to you being a filmmaker, and how do you tap into that? And how do you kind of do what you need to do in order to do what you really want to do? Because listen, back in the day, artists were all aristocrats.
Yeah.
Because they were the ones that could sit around and think and explore themselves. Everyone else was in the fucking field working. You know what I mean? So like, I mean, in our day and time, I think like people confuse, like, because I'm an artist, I should be able to support myself. And I'm like, it's never been like that.
Yeah.
Right.
No, you have to find that balance. And that's why I did the film fund. I was an English major, started out in engineering my freshman year, hated it. Quickly switched to liberal arts, but I did an entrepreneurship minor because I was like, okay, I can't read books for a living. Like, I need to inject some sort of practicality into my education and my studies.
Yeah.
So I started the film fund as a college project, and it just started gaining traction. And I'm lucky enough that it's related to my passion. It is filmmaking, but it's how I pay the bills. It's my job at the end of the day. We're not a nonprofit. We're able to give away funding, which is so awesome. And as much as I would love to be writing and directing and producing full time, you have to balance it somehow. And so this kind of lets me split up and I'm doing FF Branded, which is the corporate stuff too. So, but yeah, like I don't believe in the whole starving artist concept. I don't think being a starving artist and like, you can be an artist without being poverty stricken and, you know, living in a shithole apartment. No, I'm not saying like, I'm not rich or making money hand over fist or anything, but like, I don't think you can still get experiences in life without having to be like poor. And I think it's important to recognize the skill sets that you have and to channel them into success. Cause that'll give you, when you're not stressed and you're not struggling, that'll give you the ability to create something, you'll be in a better mindset. So I think that's important.
And it takes the pressure off it. Like the whole,
I guess that's what I'm getting at. Yeah.
Yeah. It takes the pressure off. If you have to only make money through creation of art, it's a lot of pressure and your art will suffer. You know, don't get me wrong. There's plenty of things that have been made through that method, you know, and they're great. But I think majority of the time that pressure does not serve anyone. And I think it's important to because everything will inform your art, right? Like, especially like, hey man, like look into like, maybe there's some sort of passive income you can make. Maybe there's a different, like being an artist, you're very open and you're very, you know, malleable, right? That's a really good translatable skill in a workforce that now is very flexible.
Yeah. You know, and I've noticed in my life, you know, we all go through suffering. Mine was a little earlier on in life. I had some medical things to deal with when I was younger. You're not going to generally, at least in my case, you're not going to create your art while you're going through that struggle. It's going to take years of looking back on it. Maybe not years, but it's going to take a long time for you to process it and for you to create something out of that. I mean, I'm sure it happens when people are, you know, struggling and they're suffering and they can create something in that moment. That does happen. But I think generally you need to take a step back and you need to be in that, that more low pressure environment years later, and you're able to reflect on it. You don't have that stress of dealing with the actual situation, and then you can create something based on it. So I think that's a super good, super important thing you point out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and so like my belief, like my perspective on reality is that it goes from Hinduism, right? You know, it's about the idea that like we all chose to have this experience that we're having now, whether or not you believe that doesn't matter. The point is that the experience you're having is the experience you're having, right? And so you can do two things. You can kind of go against it, or you can say, okay, I accept my experience. And my job is not to question my circumstances, but to get into the nuances of it, to understand the layers of it, right? Where is the growth, right? Because everything is trying to teach you, you know? You know, in Hinduism, there's this great story about, so there's an epic called the Ramayana, right? And the Ramayana is like, India is like Iliad and Odyssey in a way, you know. It's kind of like this huge epic tale that teaches you about morality and right and wrong. And in it, there's this guy named Ram. He's like our Jesus. And there's a guy named Robin who's like the devil, but not really, because Hinduism is not binary. It doesn't say that right, wrong, black, white. Like you know, Ram may have been like a bad guy, but he was also like a scholar. He was also very learned. He wasn't like, and that's why I like Hinduism a lot, because it goes against the binary. It's not, it's not hot, cold, left, right, wrong. Everything Hinduism is a gray area. Like we're all.
That's so interesting, because I think that I know almost nothing about Hinduism. So forgive me, but I think that's how life is. Life isn't black and white.
No.
So to study something that, like, I was raised Catholic, very traditional Catholic family. I went to Catholic school. I almost went to Villanova, and it would have been Catholic elementary school, middle school, high school.
And
I was like, I need a different experience for college. But you know,
where'd you go? By the way,
I went to Lehigh.
Okay.
In PA, still, So it's about an hour north of Philly, and it wasn't religious, and that gave me a lot of good experiences too. Seeing just different perspectives of people, because if I went to Nova, like not everyone who goes to Nova is Catholic, but a lot of people are, so it would have just been immersed in that same culture. But you know, you're raised Catholic in a certain mindset, like, especially the very, really old school. I mean, I never had nuns, but like, I had an ex-nun. It's like, oh, that's wrong. You're going to hell. You know, it's like, you do something wrong. It's very black and white. So that seems super interesting. And that's how storytelling is too. Like, stories aren't black and white. It could go in a million different directions. That might be a bit of a stretch, but I think it's an interesting parallel to make too.
No, I would say so. It's kind of funny because growing up Hindu, I didn't even learn about it as much as I did in the past 6 months, because I wrote this film that's loosely inspired by the Ramayana, but takes place in New York City, and it's about this suicidal musician who gets rescued by his neighbor. And as the film starts out, it's a two-hander that turns into a three-hander, and then you realize that not everyone you're looking at is real. So it's like a psychological thriller. And it starts to get dark, but then there's moments of levity because the musician and the protagonist kind of comes out as a way to save him. But the characters are named after the characters in the Ramayana. So you have Ram, Rav, and Hanu is the neighbor, short for Hanuman. Hanuman's monkey god. So the monkey god you'll see throughout Asia. And so as I was researching this, what I found out is that essentially Ram has to fight Ravan because Ravan stole Ram's wife, right, and took her to Lanka, which is now called Sri Lanka. That's where that was Ravan's domain. And so Ram, with the help of Lakshman, his little brother, and Hanuman, the monkey god, go to Lanka. They kill Ravan. They capture Sita, right? Sita is like basically Ram's wife. It's symbolizing our passion. He gets his passion back. And so in the Ramayana, what happens is that when Ravan is dying, Ram tells his little brother, hey, man, that's a really learned guy. Go talk to him before he dies. Learn wisdom from him. And Lakshman was like, what? We just killed him. Like, it's like, go talk to him. Lakshman's like, fine. He goes. He's like, hey, Ravan, man, my brother's like, I'm talking to you, but we killed you. Like, what can you teach me? Ravan's like, nothing. You came to me with ego. Go get your brother. Right? Lakshman's like, whatever. This guy's whack. He goes back. He gets Ram. He goes, Ram, man, he doesn't want to talk to me. He wants to talk to you. Ram comes to Ravan out of respect, bows to his feet and says, what can you teach me, oh master? Right? There's a guy that he just defeated who stole his wife. And Ravan says, because you came to me out of love, I will tell you, Ram. You see, I've been reincarnated 1,000 lifetimes to get to this lifetime. I knew that if I get killed by you, you are Vishnu, because Ram was Vishnu, the creator of all things, reincarnated. You are Vishnu. If I get killed by you, then I'm out of the cycle of life and death. My dharma is done. I'm out. So you see, I had to steal Sita. I had to take your wife because it was the only way that I knew you would kill me. So everything was planned, you know? And when I heard that, it kind of blew my mind open because, you know, where I live in Flatbush, there's a lot of street cats. I've got two little cats. And I used to, you know, for the past year, I've been walking home, seeing all the street cats. I would feel bad for them. I would feel bad because it's hot, it's cold, it's loud, it's whatever, it's dark, they're outside. And my little cats are inside. They have food, they have water, they have shelter. But something started to change because I kept looking at it. And I was like, you know what? It's kind of crazy, though. They're outside. It's hot. It's cold. It's windy. They're outside, right? Like, they're in one day, a street cat is getting more experiences than my little cats will get in a lifetime.
Yeah.
You know? Then what's the better experience? Like, that's the thing. It's not better. Like, that's the thing. It's if you believe that people chose their experiences to grow and learn, then you have freedom. You have liberation. You have peace. Now, if you don't believe that, then I'm not here to, everyone has their own way. But for me, that's what kind of has given me peace, has given me some liberation, you know?
That's so interesting. Very interested in Hinduism now. Probably won't convert today, but it seems like there are a lot of interesting. What do you would call it? Not fables, but that was a very interesting tale you told. And so that you took that and created your own story out of it. I think that's super interesting. I love drawing inspiration from religion. Really, I mean, I know you know Lord of the Rings. Was it Tolkien? He wrote a lot of. We actually studied some of it when I was in high school. We studied some of the things he wrote. Or maybe that was C.S. Lewis, or maybe it was both. Anyway, it's super interesting. But yeah. Just talking about your projects, let's talk about your project that you're doing with the Film Fund. Tell us a little bit about that.
So it's called The Chili Score. And another true story. Growing up Indian, I love spice. I eat very, very spicy food. There's a certain chili called the Indian green chili. It basically is this. It's basically the, you know, like the Thai red chilies. It's that, but green. That's the size and the composition of it. And so this is basically, you know, for us, Indian green chilies is like garlic to Italians. You got to have it in Indian food.
You're speaking my language.
Exactly. Or it's not authentic. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's whiz on a cheesesteak. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, there you go.
So in 2015, I was in Curry Hill. That's basically a part of Manhattan that's on Lexington between 23rd and 28th. It's in Murray Hill. Let's call it Curry Hill because it's all Indian restaurants on that part of Lexington. Yeah. And so I was there, and I got my customary Indian food, and I'd asked for the accompaniment of chilies on the side because it's like ketchup on a hot dog. And they told me that they don't have any Indian green chilies, and I was like, what? So I left that place. And I went to a couple of different places. No one had any Indian green chilies. So I was like, what the fuck is going on? Come to find out that there was a ban in place on Indian green chilies coming from the Dominican Republic, which is the biggest export of Indian green chilies to the U.S. So I did a little research, and I found out that there is a fly. It's called the Mediterranean fruit fly, Keratitis capitata. And they had invaded the DR, had decimated the Indian green chili crops, right? So now all of these chefs were in a panic because Indians, who are already cheap, you know what I mean? Who like don't like eating out already, it's like, you know, it's a decision that we'll make it, but it's a tough one to make. Now we're going to Indian restaurants and the food's not authentic, right? It's not spicy. Mm. So we're definitely not going to go out and eat.
Yeah.
And so Indian chefs were panicking. They tried the serrano. They tried the ghost pepper. They tried the habanero. They tried the jalapeno. They tried the scotch bonnet. No pepper could replicate the Indian green chili pepper. Right?
In terms of heat level or flavor?
In terms of...
Because those are some spicy peppers you just mentioned.
Right, right. So the reason why the Indian green chili pepper is so rare is that it explodes in your mouth and goes away and allows for the other flavors to kick in.
Okay, so it's not like a ghost pepper that just completely dominates the whole palate.
Exactly, exactly. It's spicy, but then it dissipates, you know? And so that allows the other flavors in Indian food to come through.
Mm. Dude, you're making me hungry. I didn't eat lunch yet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, dude, by the way, my brother is, he lived on North 4th Street for about 7 years. And then he still has his place here. Then he lives out in Lansdale. So I know Philly well, man.
Oh, cool. I have a friend in Lansdale, too. He's actually Indian, funny enough.
What's his name?
His name's Jigar Patel.
Wait, Jigar Patel? Wait, Jigar Patel? No. Yeah.
He went to Lehigh. Is he
a pharmacist?
No, he's a consultant.
All right. Anyways, different. I know Jigar Patel. He's
a funny guy. He introduced himself as Jigar all through college. Like, my name is Jigar. He even would say it's like cigar, but with a J. That's how I remember.
Yeah.
And then as soon as he graduated, he started going by Jigar. But now he claims like, oh, I've always gone by Jigar. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, this is not true. So he's hilarious. So I don't even know what to call my friend now. I still call him Jigar just because that's how I met him, and I've known him like since freshman year of college as that. But that would be so funny if you knew him. Small world.
That would be. But no, I mean it's a great place. But yeah, I mean I do D'Alessandro's and
D'Alessandro's
South Street.
Great.
Oh yeah, man, I used to all those haunts. But yeah, So essentially what I found out is that Indian chefs needed the Indian green chili. So what they were trying to find it, right? And so smugglers, aka criminals, figured out that not every Indian green chili in the DR was spoiled. You see, the fruit fly would decimate chili crops, but not all the Indian green chilies. But the US government was looking to take a chance and sift through all the chilies to make sure they were good or bad. Right. So they just put a blanket ban on these things. Right. So criminals went down to the DR and started to take the good Indian green chilies, ship them up to New York, and then they would sell them for 25 times the price. Right?
25 times. 5
times the price.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Wow. So
I almost
like
want to say good for them, but it's illegal. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Chili smuggling. Damn.
Chili smuggling. So cool. Yeah. Yeah. And so when I found this out, I'm like, this is freaking amazing. Like, what the heck? Can you just imagine like Michelin starred chef buying chilies off of like
crazy
back alley thugs named like, you know, so I was just like, this is amazing. So I was like,
and now are these thugs Indian?
Yes. Yeah.
That's so cool. I mean, not so cool, what, but it's like, I'm,
yeah, no, I'm, but it is cool. No, it is cool. 100%. Yeah. Like, because and 100% hell gets cool. And like, and so, and here's one thing I'll say also, like, it's interesting. Like, I think a lot of the times when people get an idea, this is why I think you need to be working on a lot of stuff. They try to do it right away. And sometimes that's not the best way, because I think the hardest part about writing a script is to take a central premise and then package it in the most dynamic way possible. And
what do you mean by dynamic? In
this so like I had this great idea. Right. Okay. The premise was there's a chili ban, right? Now, how do I package the world around it to make it a sellable TV show, right? Because I had my central idea, and now I need to understand. Okay, what is the, like, what's the style? Like, what type of tone? What type of characters would be the best sort of pieces to fill in this world? You know. And like, I thought a lot about like, is it about like the chefs and them and just about what they're going through? Is it like about like the people down who are smuggling? You know, is it more of like a real life thing where this thing actually happened? Is it a documentary? Is it like kind of like, you know, like a ridiculous comedy, you know, like knowing how to like you can have an idea, but understanding how to package it so that it has sort of a commercial appeal to it is very challenging, you know, like, because not everything should be a movie or a TV show. Like sometimes you have a great idea and maybe it should be a play, or maybe it should be a book, or maybe it should be a podcast. You know what I'm saying? Like you learn that like not everything needs to go in this medium, you know? So I had the idea. I said, okay, let me take this idea, which is like this chili band, and just lock it away for a second and just let it like sit back there. And I know one day I'm going to see something that's like, oh, that's how I fucking do this thing, you know? And so a buddy of mine, you know, basically he is this actor on the show New Amsterdam. And I think it's done now, but he was a series regular and he had worked with this. Yeah. And he worked with this pretty big Indian actor named Anupam Kher, who's like, I mean, in India, he's like huge. He's like the, I'm trying to think of an equivalent. This guy's, I don't know. He's like a, it's like a stalwart in Bollywood, you know. He's been doing it for like 50 years or something. Right.
Oh, wow.
And so that guy played his dad in New Amsterdam. So he was like, hey man, like I talked to him and he told me, is there anything that, you know, comes across my desk that me and him could play in, let me know. And I was like, okay. And I was like, this could be right for the chili score. And then I still didn't know yet, but then I watched Snatch. I rewatched Snatch.
Oh, I love Snatch. Yeah.
I'm like, dude, this is it right here.
You like dogs?
Yeah. Like, you know, it's like
I haven't seen it in a while, but I remember that line.
Yeah, you know, and it's like, oh, this is how the story has to be told. Like it has to be told, like it has to have Snatch vibes, you know. Mm-hmm. So you have this character like named Vianti, who's like this 60-year-old sultry Indian chef by day who caters to like high-end Indian diners by night. She's a ruthless villain who like tops, like, you know, like topples mayoral candidates. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like she like runs the underworld, you know what I mean? Then you have like a guy who's like this, you know, he runs the Indian Merchants Association by day, by night he runs an illegal Indian gambling hall, you know? So you have all these people and it takes place in Jackson Heights. I not Curry Hill, because Jackson Heights is a bigger sort of, you know, stage for it, you know, Jackson Heights, Queens. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it.
I'm not, no.
But yeah. So Jackson Heights, Queens is like where it's like, that's like little India. In New York, okay. It's like where all the Indians are at, and so basically, it's about these two guys that stumble upon the last batch of Indian green chilies before the ban takes effect. So now these green chilies become like the diamonds in Snatch, mm-hmm. And so all the big criminals start to come after them because they want the chilies, and so that's how. It took me a while to figure out how am I exactly going to set the table for the idea to be a dish. Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? I think that's such a challenge. At least for me, like what's the most impactful way to tell this story?
Now, can we, I have your pitch sentence pulled up.
Yeah.
Can we read that?
Absolutely.
Some filmmakers, you know, they like to keep it a secret until they release the film, but we're talking about it, so I figured you'd be cool. So let's see here. Indian chefs are left scrambling to source green chilies, essential to their food, after a 2015 federal import ban. We made a fictional film about this non-fictional event and need money for post. So that is where the Adobe Prize came into play. Yep. We don't do the Adobe Prize anymore. Vinny was a winner, I think over the pandemic, a while ago, maybe a year or so ago. But sometimes we do a post-production prize sponsored by Maestro Filmers. But this was an Adobe Creative Cloud 3-month subscription that was to help him with post-production for this film. And it's such a great pitch sentence. I mean, we talk about conflict a lot in the Film Fund, and just I want to analyze this sentence really quickly, surface level. You have so many like conflict words in this sentence. You have scrambling, that's an action word, source, essential, and it's just like all these ban. you know, federal import ban. You can visualize the conflict. Like, people are scrambling. They need to source something that's essential, and it's banned by the federal government. So, like, that's really, really compelling. You know, you have this thing that's necessary for their cuisine, their diet, their lifestyle, and they're scrambling. I just love that word, scrambling. It's like they have no wherewithal. They have they don't know what to do. And I just love it. And it makes it even more impactful that it was a non-fictional event that you're basing the story on. So I just, like, congrats on really killing that pitch. I think it's awesome. What is the status of the project?
Yeah, so we're basically finishing up. We have a couple pickup scenes that we're trying to raise money for. And so we're close. But, you know, it's like there's three films, right? The one you write, the one you shoot, the one you cut, you know. So right now we're still on the one you shoot, you know. We should be able to share it pretty soon. And what I want to say is that, like, the reason why the film fund and organizations like yourself are so important to writers is I think that you force writers to express their idea to a wide stream sort of audience, you know, like things like we get very attached to ideas and we kind of go into a vacuum, which you have to, but you know, like the film fund is a place where you have to be able to come back out of the vacuum and be like, okay, here's what I pulled out of that. Now let me go and see if that resonates, you know, with other like-minded individuals who may or may not be writers, but who are somehow involved in this craft, this art. And I feel like it's invaluable because it gives you validation in a way. It also gives you a wake up call if it's too much insider baseball, because that happens a lot, you know? So
I think that's amazing feedback. First of all, thank you for the kind words. We work really hard at the film fund. We're a very small team. It's me and a handful of freelancers, really. So, like, I'm the more conversations I have with entrants, whether they're winners or not, they always say it's been so valuable just to help me sharpen my log line and help me figure out how to pitch this film to other people, how to convey this idea and really test the waters with it. You know, I have a product development background, entrepreneurship background from school, and what they teach us is the MVP process, minimum viable product. So you make the simplest version of your product or service you can, the least expensive, you know, don't spend a lot in R&D just to test the idea. And that's the framework, the mindset I take into the film fund. I want people, I mean, you can have projects that are already established, right? But I think the film fund is a great way to test ideas too, that maybe aren't fully completed yet. Or you haven't invested a lot of resources in them just yet. And it's like, okay, let's see how this idea does before we write the whole script or before we shoot the whole thing or before we spend tons on post-production. Let's see. And then, oh, okay, this was validated. Now we can move forward and dedicate more resources to it. So that's kind of the mentality of the film fund, and it helps you experiment. It helps you get ideas out there. So I love that you're on the same page with that, and that you just thought of that organically too. I'm glad you found it useful.
Yeah, man, because like I would say that, like, depending on what you want to do, you know, some people just want to write the script. Some people want to, you know, write and, you know, be a part of the production. Some people want to be part of everything. You know, I myself am a filmmaker who wants to be a part of everything, you know? And so, dude, it's a heavy freaking lift, man, to really take something and get it made. You know, look, if you're a rich kid, it's a different thing, you know. But if to really go in, out in the world and get it made, you know, it's like it's years. I mean, it's years to years and years and years. And so, like, you better be coming to the film fund. You better be coming to other places like this to make sure the idea you're starting off with, that when that ship leaves the harbor, that you have something that you know, okay, when I meet the, you know, when I get to the other side, I'm going to have something that people are going to want, you know,
exactly.
Because it's a journey, man.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I try to keep, I wish I could enter the film fund, but I can't. I think I don't want to say I made a mistake, because I haven't, we just started submitting it to festivals. But for my most recent passion project, I try to keep my own stuff pretty separate from the film fund.
Sure.
But it's called The Toms. It's a short film, dark comedy. In a world run by Toms, a man named Tim tries to infiltrate their secret society because he feels that his name is close enough. And we got enough. It's kind of like a dystopian, yeah, you know, black comedy, dark comedy, thriller, all mixed into one. And we got enough positive feedback on the premise that I just said, okay, we're going to skip the screenwriting contest. We're going to skip the grants and everything. We're just going to go straight into production. And I think I'm looking back, I'm like, we really should have spent some more time on the script. I think it's a good film, and I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but I'm super excited to see how it does. But I think getting that feedback early on through contests and through even just peers is important.
It is. So, yeah. But I also like understand what you're saying. Like, as a creator, you're always like going to be, you know, there. I wish I had a little more room and space, of course, you know. Yeah, but I mean, that's just the nature of creating something. You're always like, you know, I mean, imagine parents, Jesus.
I
would say like one quick thing, so this last, the film I was telling you about, 14 years, which was inspired by The Remind, it's a short film, 14 pages, takes place in New York City. It's got some pretty decent. So remember Office Space?
Oh yeah. It's one of my favorite movies of all time.
Oh my God. So this is kind of crazy. The reason why I started writing films was because of Office Space.
No way.
Yeah, I swear to God. I saw that and I was like, that's what I want to do. I want to make that. And what's crazy is that this film, 14 years, you know, the Indian guy in Office Space, Ajay Naidu?
Oh, yeah. I forget the character's name. But
Yeah. He's in 14 years.
No way.
Yeah. It's insane. It's insane. And then there's another guy named Samrat Chakraborty, who's like a really sad. He's been in everything. Mr. Robot? Have you seen Mr. Robot?
Yeah, I watched every episode of Mr. Robot except like the last two for whatever reason. But Mr. Robot.
Do you remember I think it was like episode one when he walks into the coffee shop and it's the guy, he knows that the guy is running like a porn server in the back, is an Indian dude.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that's Samrat. I mean, he's done a million things, but everyone like Mr. Robot. Anyway, so like those two guys, and he... So what happens is he actually plays two versions of himself. So he plays Ram and Rav.
Oh, interesting.
So he plays his shadow self. But yeah, so essentially that script, because there is a lot of different people involved, you know, writing that thing was a nightmare because I had to go through a fucking committee for a short film.
Yeah.
But looking back on it, like, it was really good because it forced it to... And then... On the production
side, of that project, is that released or is that still?
It's being cut right now.
Okay.
Yeah. So we have three things in post right now. We have the Chili score, and we have this film. Another short film we shot back in November. So we have three things right now in post production, and then we just had something that we shot 2 years ago. It was more of like a comedy skit called Coffee Chicks. And that just got into the Austin Comedy Festival.
Oh, no way. Congrats.
Yeah. So I'm pretty psyched about that. Have you been down there at all? Have you been on the...
I haven't. Okay. No, I need to go.
I heard
Austin Film Festival stuff, and I know Austin's a big film town.
Yeah. So my entire point was that the short film we shot with the 14 years, you know, the script took by committee, so it was just a lot of work, but I'm so grateful it was. And then we were supposed to shoot on December of last year, and then COVID hit. So it pushed us back, and it was a huge blow, man, because you're trying to shoot this thing. Obviously there's money we couldn't get refunded. It was just, you know, lifting a giant boulder up a hill, and then it falls apart. As you know, it's, you know, production is a whole different beast. And then we're going to shoot in Feb, and then that fell apart, and then we lost our DP, and it was, you know, we had basically like funds were depleting, and we knew that we had one more shot at this thing. And that was what we shot in June. And then we finally, it all came together. We had a new DP. It was the right move, but the universe set it up like that. But you just you got to keep going, you know?
Yeah. Got to keep plugging. Hate to cut it off. We're having such a great conversation, but we are running out of time. I know you're past your time. You had to hop off by a couple minutes. So, Vinny, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak on our podcast today again. Do you have social media channels where people can check you out?
Yeah. You can just check me out. My Instagram handle is V4Virility. V-I-R-I-L-I-T-Y.
check that out. And check out the latest contest. We're going to do a little plugging here. Latest contests. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Summer narrative documentary contests are open now. Check out thefilmfund.co to submit your entry. Check out our social channels. We are at The Film Fund on Instagram, Film Fund Co. on Facebook, Simply Film Fund on Twitter, and The Film Fund on LinkedIn. Check the website regularly for the most up-to-date information. blog.thefilmfund.co for great filmmaking and producing tips. Check that out. Sign up for the newsletter. We will keep this quick because Vinny has to go, but we also have an ebook. Check out the website. Lots of cool stuff. Thank you again, everyone, for listening. And if you're watching, we have this cool new green screen background so I can hide my messy apartment behind me, which is where we run the company out of. Did you just take a screenshot or does that?
Yeah, I took a screenshot. Yeah.
Love it. Yeah. Thank you so much again. Do you have anything else you'd like to add, Vinny, before we wrap up?
Nah, man. Get those log lines working, man. If you can't get those log lines working, then maybe you should think twice about writing that script.
So, exactly. Log line is so important.
So important.
Thanks, everyone, again. Tune in every other Friday for new episodes. We'll catch you later.